Sasha.
Also, just to orient you guys to the new voices, if you haven't met them or don't know who they are, you should say hi to them. They're first-time third coasters from all over the country, and they came here through AIR, a scholarship program. So we want to start off with some fun numerical facts. I actually have some fun numerical facts about Asha. They all have to do with the number 31. So at one point, Asha had some kind of injury incident that resulted in 31 stitches. Her birthday is also on the 31st, and it's statistically likely that this December 31st, New Year's Eve, she'll be in Curacao. 31.
And I have the distinct pleasure of introducing my reveal colleague, Laura Starczewski. Laura Starczewski, everybody. And I have three mind-blowing numerical facts. One, Laura was arrested twice. She's had three major surgeries. And at her smallest, she weighed 2 pounds, 10 ounces.
All right. I made it. And my numerical fact about Ike Sriskandaraja is all about the number 3. And amazingly, Ike's first memory has to do with the number 3, which I couldn't believe when he told me that. So basically, Ike is a little guy. He's actually 3 years old. One of his daily tasks is to go out to the end of the driveway and pick up the newspaper. And when he picks up the newspaper, it often has a sticker on it, which is like the delivery zone that the paper boy uses to know which houses to go to. And the sticker that day was the number 3, except it was a lucky day for Ike, who loved stickers, because there were 2 stickers, and there were 2 number 3s, and his mother was 33 years old. And so Ike had a big revelation where he was like, I'm 3, my mom's 33, there's 2 stickers with the number 3, and that's his earliest life memory.
That's
Ike. Ike Sriskandaraja.
That's when the lights came on. So we're warm. Now the mic's hot. So we want to warm up the audience with a live data sonification experiment, testing the vanguard of IRL data sonification. This one is all about travel distances to this conference. So I'm gonna set up 4 groups for you guys, and then we're gonna assign different sounds based on how far you travel. So how many people here use no motor vehicle to come? So these Chicago people who maybe took a bus or walk. Wait, no, that's not a bus, has a motor. Who walked here or took a bike? How about a bus? Or a train? Where are my Chicago people at? Okay, so for all the Chicago people in the house, could one of you suggest a sound? That'll be your sound for that I'm going to call on later. It could be like a ding or a Blackhawk. Is there a Cubs sound, like a bear or something? Oh, you got Cubs and bears. It could be a bear sound.
Chirping.
So what is it? You guys all want to agree on a sound? A bird chirping. The pigeon. The coot. That thing?
Yeah, that's good.
That's good. Okay.
Pidgey.
Okay, so you're the chirp. Chirp. You want to practice it once? All right. Okay. All right. That's Chicago. Let's see, the second group?
People who came drove across state lines in a car. Anybody? Couple? All right. Okay, what sound do y'all want to be? What is that? Like a siren cat sound? That's good. That sound? Okay, all right, let's practice that one. Drove over state lines. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And there's some seats in the front if you guys want to fill out the people in the back. Feel free. There's 10 seats up here. No pressure.
Okay. So then that was drove over state lines.
That was over state lines. How about time zone? Time zone people? Wow. Okay. So do you guys want to decide a sound for the time zone people?
Do you mean cross time zones?
Crossed a time zone.
Crossed a time zone. Ooh, TikTok.
Okay, you want to practice that real quick? Okay. And then our fourth group are our international guests. Welcome to this great week in America. Okay. Glad to have you. Thanks for coming. Do you guys want to figure what's the? That could be the plane taking off.
Yawn?
Okay, so you guys are the yawn group. Do you want to practice real quick? Okay. We're going to, it's going to be tricky because you're going to have to keep up yawning, which is a hard thing to do.
No problem.
Got it.
And we passed, we placed some microphones out there. I hope they're on, just because we thought that might pick up some of what you're doing, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Great. So now I think we're going to start with the sustained Chicago people. Start, and then we're going to build, try to score this. All right.
Okay, now, people who drove over state lines. A little more, again, drove over state lines.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
Okay.
Cross
time zones?
And came from outside America. All right.
All right.
That was great. You guys sounded awesome.
You know, sometimes data sonification tells us something, and it's not right for everything. Lesson number one. Just a little bit about our backgrounds that we skipped is that neither of us have a long history in the thing that we're here to talk about, and we kind of got thrown into it when we started at Reveal. So we're both about a year and a half in to this job where we think about it all the time.
Because we work with reporters who bring us like stacks of documents and Excel spreadsheets and statistics, and these are all their findings that they're really excited to convey, and then we have the challenging task of trying to make that work on the radio and make sense and actually come across to people in a story. So this is like something we deal with every show that we work on, I would say.
Yeah, every show has some finding that a reporter spent some long amount, months, maybe a year, and it's often rooted in a number. And part of our jobs are conveying those numbers. And we're learning on the fly, you know? So we're going to share a couple of our favorite examples, some of the lessons, and we hope that it's a conversation. So, we're all here to share information and ideas and how to do this better.
And those mics are still somewhere, and they're for Q&A. So if you have a question, just because all the sessions are being recorded and they're going to be archived for other people to listen to and learn from and laugh at, that if you have a question, just get a hold of that mic so that it can be recorded.
Cool. Should we start with the creative examples?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it.
This first one is, so Laura and I were talking about creative things that we've learned from great examples on the radio that really stuck with us, and we each pick one. I hadn't heard this one example for like 10 years, but it's still like crystal clear in my mind. I couldn't believe it. It's Radiolab. It's from 2008. They are aces at this game, and this is from an episode called Emergence.
Picture it. There's a riverbank in Thailand in the remote part of the jungle. You're in a canoe, slipping down the river. There's no sound of anything, maybe the occasional, you know, exotic jungle bird or something. And you're looking and you just see, whoop, 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 with thousands of lights on and then off, all in sync.
Imagine all the trees, as far as you can see, are all brilliantly lit and then totally dark. Brilliantly lit, total darkness.
How many of you have heard that example? And did it stick with you too? Like it's, and it's illustrating not a number but a mathematical concept, which is emergence, all these disparate pieces acting in synchronicity, in unison, without communication. Just fish swimming, birds turning, and in this particular example, fireflies flashing.
So I'm going to play, that's like a really beautiful scored example. I'm going to play a kind of more theatrical, doing things in front of the microphone example. Planet Money, like us, also wrestles with this question all the time of how to do numbers on the radio. And I asked Robert Smith, he's not in here, is he? Okay, I asked Robert Smith for his favorite examples of like the funnest stuff that they've done. And he shared this example with me. It's him and Andrea Seabrook talking about the wealth gap.
The CBO report has great graphs and charts to illustrate just how much more the wealthy have added to their incomes over the past 30 years. Sadly, graphs and charts make terrible radio. So I picked up the Nerd Hotline and got one of the Planet Money team, NPR's Robert Smith. He raided his daughter's stash of Halloween candy corn and came up with a kind of audio graphic so we can hear how people's incomes have changed. And we start with the poor.
Each little candy corn is worth about $1,000 of annual income. So let's look back 30 years ago, say. In 1979, you would have made this many candy corns, 10.
Okay.
30 years later, you're doing a little bit better in society. You are doing about 2 candy corns better.
2 candy corns better.
You're making about $2,000 more a year.
Okay, that's an 18% increase according to the CBO numbers here, yes?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, talk about the middle.
Sure. 1979, if your family made $30,000 a year, you were well in the middle. So here's what 30 candy corns sounds like. You know, not bad. Pretty good for the middle class. Over the last 30 years, you would make about 12 candy corns more. Here we go.
Okay, that's an increase of about 40%.
Everyone's doing a little bit better over the last 30 years. But the increases are fairly modest all the way up until you get to the rich.
Okay.
Are you ready for the rich?
I'm ready for the rich.
Now, everyone talks about the top 1%, and so that's what we're going to go to. The whole family would have made, let's say, around $200,000 a year. Here's 200 candy corn.
Okay, it's a good haul. How much are they making now? What's the difference?
Well, this is the real news of the study.
Mm-hmm.
Their annual income. Their annual candy corn take-home haul. Let me start to pour this. 550 more candy corns a year, and they're spilling all over the table here. But this, any kid in America would love to have this many candy corns.
According to the numbers that I have here, that's an increase of 275%.
And when they talk about income inequality in America, this is what they're talking about.
Okay, candy corn. So I asked Robert, how did you guys come up with candy corn? And he said, well, we knew we needed particle candy, which I didn't realize was like a category of thing. And it was around Halloween time. And he also told me that they spent a lot of time trying to find the right bowl that would make the right sound for the candy corn to fall into that would sound the best. So if you're doing something fun and experimental, you also have to kind of be dogged in your creativity. That's the lesson for me there.
So those are two good examples. We're not just going to give you the good stuff. We're going to give you the going to give you the misses, too, so we can learn from them and pick them apart. And we're going to talk about the first numbers that we encountered while we were young radio reporters. And my example, the first time I had to grapple with presenting a number on the radio was when I was at KFSK in southeastern Alaska. It's like one station on the dial sort of town. And I was the morning edition host for a summer in 2007, which was an internship, which is sort of weird. Morning edition. You know, you kind of think those guys are, but you know, that could be an entry-level job. And one of my jobs, so this is like it's a little island in southeastern Alaska, 17 million acres of rainforest. We have a North American rainforest. And gray, icy, glacial waters, and it's also the waterways around it are filled with salmon. Wait, so just to give you a sense, like this was my job. Every day I would go in, because I had to go into the archive to find this. I'm going to give you just a little taste of what I did every morning. Good morning. It's just before 7:24 on August 16th, 2007. 55 degrees, blue skies outside. I'm Mike Sreeskandaraja with KFSK's second newscast of the morning. And in a town that has a lot of salmon and salmon industry, it's the second largest salmon exporter, very productive small island. So fishery news leads the broadcast. I mean, I'm also doing, because it's one station on the dial and you're in a remote place, you have to read like messages to people, like birthday greetings and anniversaries and dental appointments to people who live in places with no phone. Alaska is a great place to learn radio. I don't know if anybody's from Alaska in here. Big ups to Alaska. And the salmon fisheries was the report I would have to would lead the news. So here's an example of.
Pink salmon fishing was slow during the early part of the season, and it looked like the run may be a repeat of last year's dismal showing with a catch of less than 12 million pinks. 2006 was the worst season in two decades. But this year, in the middle of the season, some areas in Southeast are starting to improve. The regional seine total is at about 10 million pink salmon. Southern Southeast catches are about 30% above the 10-year average, but northern Southeast catches are about 50% below average at this point, according to the department.
So you got all that right. maybe you're on your boat, maybe you're reeling in a purse seine. So that was an example of how to make numbers not generally memorable to a large audience. So it's full of industry jargon. It's full of numbers without context. Now I've been at Reveal for a year and a half, and the first time that I had my first assignment at Reveal was actually to translate this one number. And this is when I started to like think about it and how to actually make those numbers stick. So the first story I worked on was with a data reporter named Mike Corey, who'd been looking into earthquakes in Oklahoma. Oklahoma is not a place traditionally associated with earthquakes, but over the last decade, there has been a crazy amount of them. A lot of them are small, but some of them are sizable. Even last week, there was a 5.0, 5.3. And so Mike Corey had been working on this, looking into this issue, and he found out that in 2014, Oklahoma had more than three times as many earthquakes as California. And we wanted to make that idea stick. So this is what we came up with.
So how do you go from almost no earthquakes to being one of the most seismically active places in America? That's what Reveal's Michael Corey wanted to find out.
Hi, Al. Yeah, I've covered earthquake safety in California in the past, but that makes sense. This place is known for earthquakes. And then I found out that Oklahoma actually is now more seismically active than California, kind of like a lot more. And I wanted to know what was going on. So, Al, check this out.
Mm-hmm. So, what was that?
This is earthquakes in Oklahoma, and we basically ran Oklahoma's earthquake data through a synthesizer to give you a sense of what's going on there. This is about 2005, 2006, so each plink there is one earthquake.
Okay, so it's kind of speeding up now, right?
Yeah. This is about 2009, and you're hearing that something is definitely changing. And during the same time, oil and gas prices were way up, and Oklahoma was starting a big increase in oil production.
Wow, that is a big one.
Okay, yeah, that was the big earthquake in Prague, Oklahoma in 2011. We'll come back to that one.
Okay. It sounds like pinball. I used to have a pinball machine. Oh, wow, it's a lot.
Yeah, this is like today.
Yeah, I'm fine, but okay. Is there going to be more?
We have no idea.
That last part was in 911 call, 911 call. And so hopefully at the end of that... Oh, I should stand up again. Hopefully at the end of that, you feel the reverberations that people in Oklahoma are dealing with every day. That was the idea, and making it stick a little bit more than Oklahoma has now, three times as many earthquakes as California. So what Mike did was he took that, he had a spreadsheet of data and turned it into like assigned musical values based on the size of the earthquake and like laid it out over a decade, sped up in that time period. And he made this, like it's not gonna work for every data set, you can't go to this well all the time, but it is a publicly available, he made the code that he wrote for it open source. And when I asked him if radio reporters who maybe don't have a GitHub account yet, or know what that means.
How many of you guys have a GitHub account? Oh,
that's pretty good.
I don't. You guys are awesome.
I do now.
All right.
Well, he's really enthusiastic. He wrote like a how-to. It's on the Reveal's website. He'd be happy to answer any like line questions. And I wanted him to give us a little message of hopefulness for anybody wanting to try it.
Okay, Ike has asked me, can a radio reporter easily do data sonification? I'll say, if you're the kind of person who likes tinkering with things, pushing buttons and seeing what happens, I think you can totally do it. There's a little code involved, but there's a lot of examples out there with some code, and really all you gotta do is just change things and see what happens. So if you like tinkering and you're even slightly musically inclined, I say go for it. You're gonna do cool stuff.
So basically, what you need to, if you are considering it, which I would recommend kicking the tires on, you just need a set of data where the numbers go up or down over time. And then if you are musically inclined, in our office, we happen to have the benefit of a Jim Briggs, Jay Breezy, front row, who is a musician and can make those spreadsheets sound gorgeous. And I just wanted to play one of the versions that Jim made without people talking over it, so you can get a sense. Thank you.
Okay, so that's another really beautiful musical. I just think that's so cool sounding, and it's really haunting. Yeah, question, do we know where those mics are at? Somebody's got one for you.
First, what's a GitHub account?
Does somebody else who maybe uses it more regularly than me?
GitHub account is where you stash your code that you're using to create applications or write software, and it's designed so that other people can access it. It's based on open source principles.
So you have to know how to code? Yeah?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's a good place to start because you are using real examples that people have made work. You could download somebody's code and then run it and see how it works.
Okay, thank you. The other question I have is, the pretty stuff that you're putting with the data and the spreadsheets, is there a more conventional narrative repertorial piece to that?
Yeah, of course. This is just the...
This is just a moment.
These are
moments in the...
This is the lead, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of what you can do if you have a really smart data reporter who also can write code and an engineer who also is a musician and can score things at your disposal.
I mean, if you got that,
yeah,
you're fine.
Sky's the limit. Can somebody pass the mic up?
But really, Mike gave me 50-50 odds, and I would say maybe for you it's 60-40.
Of being able to pull it off. If you brought your own data set and wanted to try to use that code.
Hello.
Hi.
I just had a question. I love the way that sounds with the earthquake data. It's really beautiful. But there's a lot of other data sets that I was just thinking, it's just harder to imagine scoring, like, number of lawsuits filed over time over a particular thing, or maybe something a little bit heavier, like number of hate crimes going up over time. So I was just wondering if you've used this technique for stories that you've reported or have been reported on things that aren't, like a natural activity or maybe that, I don't know, gave you some pause about how do you approach it considering the subject matter.
Well, if I could call in Jim for a second to talk about the Orlando example.
What would you guess?
Jim Briggs, everybody.
I wasn't expecting this. I mean, would it be better if you asked questions about it, or do you want?
Yeah, because that was another example. So after the Orlando nightclub shooting, we were making a quick turnaround show that spoke to that event, and Jim produced a variety of of this idea, a sonification. Mm-hmm. Of the lives lost that night.
I think one thing that we found, I mean, one, we were working on a much tighter turnaround than we were for, say, the Oklahoma piece, where we had a lot of time to think about this data set. So I think one thing that we really realized was that, time could force us to make some quick decisions about, I mean, it's almost like an editorial process in the, like, what to cut, what, omit the unimportant. How can we do something really direct with this? And it's something that I felt like we were lucky in a journalistic environment that we had people in the editorial staff and producers who were willing to let us do this to kind of signify the number of lives lost and then what happens in the, if you've heard the piece, is basically you're hearing a sequence where each tone is the birth of one of the victims. And then at the end, it comes to an end. So we just found that there were a lot of kinds of data that we had available. There were a lot of different stories that could be told, but what was the one that was the most powerful for us? And, how could we reduce the data set to, give us something powerful to work with? So that was something where Mike and I, and then, we had interns too, who were just furiously, trying to grab, like, what's the birth date? I mean, if you want to get really granular about it, like, I, took, every month of the year, kind of had a position. So it would be like, if you were thinking about musical bars, every musical bar has 12 possible steps, right? So, you know, then that gave me a cue of like how to place this with enough variety so that, you know, interesting things are happening. Every year has its own tone. So, and those repeat every year.
Thanks.
Yeah?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So that's about
it. I don't know. I think that any data set could, you could put it through this. It just would have to match the tone of the rest of the piece that you were doing. And if it's something heavy, then it should sound grave and heavy. And if it's something that's, I mean, earthquakes are pretty serious too, but if it was something that just, you know, had, was just purely fun, then it would, you could do it and it could sound purely fun also. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about, oh, go ahead.
Oh, just one question. The sounds are very pretty, but unless you're hear what's coming down the pike, you really don't know. It's, you know, tinkling the sounds or the you know, tinkling in a crate. Do you back announce or how do you keep the listener understanding if somebody didn't listen to the whole piece?
Well, that wouldn't last a whole piece. So that would just be the top of a segment. So like a springboard into an issue about earthquakes in Oklahoma, and then we'd go into the why, the how, and the like political reality of what's happening. So we wouldn't keep revisit. Like, I mean, I could imagine times where you might want to revisit it or make it thread through other parts, but I think it's, you know, just the same way you would introduce it, like the sound as a character, right? So
we're using it as a hook a lot.
Yeah, it's not designed to carry all of the information. It's just one way of getting at it.
Yeah, like you're not going to get the difference between fracking and natural gas injection, like wastewater injection wells, by listening to a Gatling gun of pings and pongs. That comes after. But hopefully you're like leaning in a little bit more.
So I'm going to talk about some examples that just have to do with writing and reporting, and that you may have already gotten a clue that this is usually the kind of thing that I end up working on, because to me, like, I kind of just lump in data sets, spreadsheets, percentages, statistics. It's all part of some kind of mass of numbers that I try to kind of avoid in actually the radio storytelling that I do. And I just want to, like Ike said, you know, neither of us are had a ton of experience with data sets before starting at Reveal. We're still getting used to it, and I just wanted to play a little bit of the first time that I tried to use a number in a story. The way that this came about is kind of, I think it's one of a trope of how you can end up using numbers in a story. For me, it was just like, I heard a statistic that blew my mind, and then that led me to report a story and try to figure out why that statistic was the way that it was. And the statistic was, this was in 2010, and the statistic was that 1 in 7 Latina teenage girls will attempt suicide, and that's more than any other teenage girl demographic. So I just was like, whoa. I can't even remember actually where I heard that statistic, but I was trying to understand why would that possibly be true, what would an explanation be. So I decided to do a story for it. I did a story for Latino USA and profiled a girl who was a 16-year-old Dominican-American girl who had just come out of the hospital, and I followed her for a year, right? So I just still had this like 1 in 7 number as my jumping off point. And then it kind of turned out through the reporting that her story fit in really perfectly with a small body of research that did explain, at least had one like suggested explanation for why that statistic might be. So I'm just gonna play a little excerpt, one scene in that piece, so you can get a sense of her. This is from the middle of the piece.
Yanira spent 3 days in the hospital that January. She said she liked the night nurse who called her sweetheart and let her stay up late talking on the phone. At home, that's against her mom's rules. And her mom's rules are where the story really starts. Yanira's mother did not want to be interviewed. Yanira says her mom is stubborn, good at getting what she wants, and Yanira's named after her.
I look like my mom, a little. her black, 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 black hair. My hair is black, black, black. The way she smiles, I got that from her. Her sense of humor.
And what are your mom's rules about where you can go now?
I could only go wherever she goes. That's it. There's no discussions, no nothing.
No hanging out with friends. No boyfriends. Yanira can only go back and forth between her apartment and her high school. Okay, so that's Yanira's story. And the explanation, which Latino USA ended up kind of building an episode around this story and the research, is just that girls like Yanira feel trapped between being an American teenager and then being Latina daughters of Latina mothers who weren't born in America, who have totally different expectations of them. So there are kind of two sets of expectations put on them, and that was, this is not like, at the time when I did the story, there was one study about this, so sure, there's room for further research, but there was at least one explanation for that statistic, and it kind of sent me off on that reporting story hunt. And then there's like a flip version of the same kind of thing. That's a way I like to think of using statistics in your storytelling. I just call this strategy like use just one number. And the goal is that you wanna hook people in with your story and get them deep into it, get them caring about a character, get them engaged with the narrative. Maybe there's some twists and turns. And then somewhere in there, you're going to drop in an illuminating statistic. So I stole this technique from Elise Spiegel. She's now at Invisibilia. She used to be at This American Life. I just want to play a couple excerpts from the piece that kind of crystallized this technique for me. This is a piece Elise did back in 2003. And I just want you to pay attention to how the story starts. This is the very top of the piece.
This is partly a story about Muslims and non-Muslims not seeing eye to eye, but it's also about how that kind of dispute can affect a family and affect it in a really big way, a surprisingly large way. Elise Spiegel tells what happened.
This sad story begins with a happy one, a love story set in a location not usually associated with love stories, the West Bank. It was there that Sari met her husband, a man with a wonderful sense of humor who, like Sari, felt strongly about his Islamic faith.
Okay, so we do learn in that intro that this is going to be a story about Muslims and non-Muslims not seeing eye to eye. I had already planned on playing this example before this week's news, but it's becoming relevant again because you eventually learn 8 minutes into the story that this is a story about kids in a Muslim family getting bullied and ostracized at a school in New Jersey. You don't get there for 8 minutes. And then 30 minutes into the story, you hear the one kind of contextual statistic that Elise drops into the narrative. And this is the mother of those kids who were bullied at the school in New Jersey.
I have to believe this was a fluke. I have to. Otherwise, it's really hard to keep moving forward. But I also think it's a sign of our times. You know, it's happening all across America. It's not just happening in our little town here. You know, we hear stories of different things going on in, you know, in schools and places of employment and, you know, public places and restaurants.
From his post at the Justice Department, Eric Treen, in his own way, has seen the same thing.
There's been a dramatic rise in hate crimes since 9/11 against Muslims, Arabs, Sikhs, who are often mistaken as being Muslim, and South Asians, and sometimes people with a dark skin, such as a Portuguese man, because they're perceived to be Arab or Muslim.
In fact, says Treen, since 9/11, one in five of the complaints reviewed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission involves a case of discrimination against Muslims. That number, one in five, is, of course, totally out of proportion to the number of Muslims that live in America.
Okay, so I just want to deconstruct that a little bit and just point to a couple of things that Elise does that you can do and that I do. I'm going to play an example where I do them in a minute. Repeat the number, Like, there's only really one number in the story. She repeats it twice. It's just very hard to get numbers to stick in people's minds when they're just hearing them. Even when they're embedded in a really amazing narrative like this, repeating the number can really help. She contextualizes it by saying, this is totally out of proportion with the actual number of Muslims in America. Like, the 1 in 5 statistic, that's kind of striking. But then when you think about that deeper contextualization, it goes by kind of fast. It's not essential, but if you're listening out for it, you can pick it up. And I actually asked Elise, like, for a little bit of the backstory of how did she find that number, and did she start with that number and then go find the story of this family? How did it all happen? Did she ever think about starting the story with the number at the top? So I asked her that. Did she ever think about just starting with the statistic? And she says, I will say to that, no. I would never start with numbers unless the numbers were so insane that they made my mouth fall open just hearing them spoken out loud. My basic feeling is you just have to catch people immediately, particularly these days. You need to give them something that holds them in the first 20 seconds. Narrative is much more likely to do that for me than numbers, so I would usually start with narrative. And then I asked her, like, okay, so you started with the narrative. She must have heard about the story of this family and dug in and reported with them. And then so I asked her, okay, well, where'd the number come from? When did you first hear it? And she says, I do remember when I heard about the statistic. And I'm sorry I don't have a better story here, but the truth is that the amazing Julie Snyder, who's here, I think, doing a session this weekend, was editing me. And she listened to the first draft and was all, call the Justice Department and get their side. So I did. And I talked to Eric Treen and got the statistics from him. So to me, there's just like two takeaways. Like, great editors are great, because I think that makes the story much stronger. And second, just when you have an opportunity to show the scope of a problem, one statistic can really, really go a long way. And I'm just going to play an example of when I really did just bite Elise's style and use just one number in a reveal story. This was a reporter named Maeve McClanigan in London, who is primarily a print reporter, and she had been doing a really amazing investigation for over a year about this quirk in the immigration system in England, where if you're under 18 and you come into the country seeking asylum, you can kind of get caught in this weird netherworld where they don't grant you asylum, but they don't deport you. And so there are all these teenagers in the UK who are waiting for their asylum cases to get sorted out, but they don't get sorted out. And then when they turn 18, they can be deported. So they go to school, they learn English, they assimilate, and then they're deported back to places like Afghanistan. And so when Maeve brought the story to us, I'll just, like, this is what she wanted to put in the radio story. She had been working on this. She's an investigative reporter, been working on it for over a year. She sent me this kind of list of facts she wanted to put in. In 2015, more war refugees than in any prior year since World War II flooded Europe from the Middle East and Africa. In 2015, 54% of kids seeking asylum in the UK were given a form of temporary leave to remain. If you look back over the decade, it's even more. 66% got temporary status instead of refugee status. Afghan children were being given asylum at a much lower rate than other children. In the past 9 years, Afghan children were more than twice as unlikely to get asylum than the average child. And it just kind of goes on. There's a bunch more. I won't read them all. But if you're like me, you want to know about this, but you're starting to get kind of lost because there's a ton of numbers there. So when Maeve brought the story to us, she had been working on this from a lot of different angles, but there was one main guy she'd been following, so we decided we'll just build the radio story around him. We're going to go deep into his story, and then we just dropped a statistic in one scene in the middle, and this is a scene after he's turned 18, he's 19, he's been detained in an immigration detention center, and isn't sure if he's going to be deported. And the only person he really knows who can help him is his English teacher, Laura. So that when you hear the name Laura, that's who that is.
While he was in detention, he was handed a plane ticket 7 times and told to get ready. He'd be deported soon. Laura helped him find a lawyer and stop every deportation attempt. By the time he got out, after 3 months, they were like family.
I can say she's like my mom, like my sister, my dad, and everything, because she cares about me so much like a parent.
But after that, Abdul felt different. Like being returned to Afghanistan was a real possibility. In fact, after a long battle getting data out of the government, I found that in the last 9 years, more than 2,000 people, like Abdul, have been sent back to Afghanistan. 2,000 people who'd arrived in the UK as children, been given temporary permission to stay, studied, learned English, and then were deported after they turned 18.
Okay, so it was really tempting to use a bunch of those other statistics, especially because he's from Afghanistan, and we learned that kids from Afghanistan are much more likely to be deported. They're less likely to receive asylum. But in the end, like, we just had to choose the one really powerful statistic, and to me it was the fact that there were 2,000 other people like this. So it's all about context.
And once you get to know Abdul and, like, in his family relations and, like, the close ties he have, and to picture 2,000 kids just like that, like, just is heartbreaking to me, and a nice example. So I'm going to stay on the teens beat.
Teen and, beat.
And play an example where this is a youth radio story. It's a first-time reporter. So before I worked at Reveal, I worked at youth radio. And I was working with this young reporter named Edna Miller, and it was it's one of my favorite youth radio stories. I think it actually was nominated for a Third Coast Award for a news feature last time, straight out of the gates, you know, first time. It's pretty good. And she was really out of her comfort zone. It's a story about this youth decoy program that police departments use teenagers to do straw purchases in front of. So it's a teenager asking somebody to buy a six-pack of beer or a pack of cigarettes, and we did a ride-along with a Alameda sheriff, and she's not very comfortable with cops. So she was, all that to say, she's out of her comfort zone, and here is that segment. I want you to listen for the number. Just keep in mind, like, what we've been talking about, and I'll ask you a question. What number stood out to you afterwards?
I'm in an unmarked car, charging towards a startled man in a black Chevy.
He's trying to drive up. Oh, my God.
The sergeant jumps out of the driver's seat and runs towards the suspect on foot, while out-of-sight officers in bulletproof vests swarm in, cutting off the man's escape routes.
Oh, snap.
His crime? Buying a six-pack of Coors Light for an undercover teen.
I'm Daniel, I'm the decoy. I'm the guy that messes up people's days, I guess.
That's Daniel Gardner, an 18-year-old youth decoy. Plain clothes and not wearing a bulletproof vest. He's undercover with the Alameda County Sheriffs. The officers just arrested a middle-aged man in a sweatsuit. The violator, a guy named Fred, is the fourth person busted for buying alcohol for a minor at this location in the past hour and a half. Fred has his reasons.
Hey, dude, I was so
tell you why I did it.
Listen. Right.
You're the same height as my son, and you look kind of like him. You white, though, but you look kind of like him. Same bill, you feel me?
All that drama and a $200 to $1,000 fine may seem like a severe penalty for selling tobacco to a minor. Back at the alcohol decoy operation, Sergeant Schuler says these things sometimes catch people engaged in worse crimes.
A lot of times what we find is the people that are willing to buy alcohol for a minor, a lot of times they've been involved in other criminal activity.
According to the statewide agency that sponsored these operations, about 10% of people cuffed today actually went to jail on crimes ranging from drunk driving, illegal drug possession, to resisting arrest.
Thanks, sir. So, what was the most important number to you in that segment?
Two. Four people in the last hour and a half.
$200,000 fine? Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I love this piece, but I think the most important number kind of got lost in it. And it got lost in our editorial process. It got lost in, this was on Marketplace. It got lost in theirs. But when I played this as an example for a group of teenagers considering youth radio, they got it immediately, and it, like, took me aback. And it was that this sheriff says a lot of people are out here doing bad stuff, and we're catching them. Like, we're catching, you know. And then when we ran the numbers and, like, went through all of the arrests made that day, 10% had parking tickets, like, outstanding, you know, the list that she gave. That's not a lot, you know. So they were more attuned and zoned in on that, and I thought that was a, sort of a missed opportunity. One, so the two lessons I take away from that is when people say casually, like, in tape a lot or most or few or, you know, those are words that have numerical values attached to them, and don't let those go by unchecked or unconsidered.
Cats.
Let's lighten the mood.
We're going to make a hard turn to cats.
Okay. This is an excerpt from a story, a reveal story that a colleague of ours did. Aditya Sambamurthy looked into the policies around what to do with feral cats in cities across America. So, you know, it's not all about deep injustice and sexual violence and people getting, you know. This one's about cats. And this is a story about one of his findings was that the major policy that cat proponents are pushing is a trap, neuter, return. In the segment, they're going to call it TNR. And that's catching cats, you know, rounding them up behind the Aubon pan and neutering them and then returning them to the streets. And it has a shaky scientific premise.
Will trap, neuter, and return help reduce the cat population? I looked at a bunch of studies that reached different conclusions, and then I spoke with Dr. Patrick Foley. He's a population biologist at California State University in Sacramento, and he's the only academic who's analyzed two of the largest, longest-running TNR projects in the country, one in San Diego, the other in Gainesville, Florida.
Cat populations were not significantly going down, and that's probably the single take-home lesson here.
Meow, meow. The kitty cat is cooing.
Dr. Foley says the problem is that cats are so fertile.
Meow.
A single female can give birth to as many as 6 kittens in one litter.
Meow.
Meow.
Within 4 years, that cat can have as many as 4,000 descendants.
Meow.
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 And after 8 years, the number jumps to as many as 64,000.
Meow.
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 All from one cat.
I don't think that needs any explanation, right?
No, I don't think so. I'm going to play one other reveal excerpt that sounds a little different this week after the election. This is a strategy that it's kind of related to the I heard a statistic that blew my mind and I wanted to do a story about it, but it's sort of a twist on that. I was doing some stories on voting rights in Texas, and my editor, Andy, told me that if everyone who could vote in Texas voted, Texas would be a blue state. And I was like, oh, wow, okay, that's pretty amazing. And it had a strong relationship to some of the stories on voting rights that we were doing in the hour. So I wanted to find a way to illustrate that on the radio. I decided to call to go see a political scientist in Houston named Bob Stein and try to have that idea come out in a scene with him. And this is what happened.
Voter turnout in Texas is low. It's especially low among Hispanic voters. On the whole, only about 1 in 5 eligible voters in Texas actually cast a ballot. So I started thinking, what about those other 4 eligible voters? What if they all voted? And I asked Bob Stein that.
What would that outcome look like?
It would be less. I still think Trump would win, but probably not.
Can't you just hear Bob thinking about this question while he answers it?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't sound like he really knows the answer.
That's because he doesn't. But he didn't want to stay in my fantasy world of 100% voter turnout. Because that's absurd. It would never happen. Bob kept steering things back to the real world, so I kept asking him the exact same question.
Just in this fantasy world where 100% of eligible voters vote, what happens in the presidential election?
I think there is a reasonable chance that Hillary Clinton could win the state of Texas.
There's a good chance that Hillary wins, or Hillary wins Texas?
I think just a good chance.
Bob actually got so obsessed with this question that after our interview, he crunched more numbers and he sent me an email with a new answer. He said he had underestimated the power of these Democratic voters. He wrote that if every registered voter voted, not just eligible voters, people who have already registered, Hillary wins Texas by a long shot, somewhere between 81,000 and 500,000 votes.
You heard it here first. Hillary won.
So I broke the rules a little bit and just added in some statistics at the end, some numbers at the end about the number of votes. I don't know why I did that. I feel like those could have probably not been included there. But I think what really helped that scene work was the fantasy world music, again from Jim, who helped us kind of make that come alive a little bit. And when I went into that interview, I thought Bob Stein seemed like this like super energetic guy who was really fun to talk to on the phone. And I thought he would just like go on this journey with me, and he was not into it at all. Like, he just kept kind of wanting to talk about his other research that has to do with real people outside in the real world and how they behave in elections. And so I had to kind of make his reluctance part of the scene. And I think we're just about to, we have like 10 minutes left, and we wanted to talk about In the Dark as a really amazing example of using numbers and graphs effectively on the radio. Is anyone from In the Dark here?
Madeline's here.
Oh, hi, Madeline. Yay, okay. Awesome. So there's a lot that we could talk about with In the Dark. How many of y'all have listened to it? All right. Okay, if you haven't listened to it, listen to it. Just the basic premise is it's a 9-episode podcast that explores the disappearance and, as we know now, murder of a boy named Jacob Wetterling 27 years ago in Minnesota. And it goes a lot of different places, but the main question is why did it take 27 years to solve this crime, and what were the ripple effects of why that investigation went so badly? So to me, like, I love the whole thing, but episode 8 is where it really like hits a crescendo, and the main question in episode 8 is this local sheriff's department that was investigating this crime, was there some other, is, hold on, I just want to actually read. How good are they really at solving major crimes? That's like the big picture frame question. How good are they? How good is the sheriff's department at solving major crimes? And this episode goes in a lot of different places, but to me, the real numbers stuff comes in when Madeline and their data reporter, Will Kraft, do a lot of work and create a graph that shows the solve rates or the clearance rates of the sheriff's department. And in the very beginning, when we first got into this room, I think in that Planet Money piece, Andrea Seabrook said that graphs and charts make terrible radio. And what's amazing to me about this example is that it totally proves that wrong. So they've got this amazing graph, and they do a lot of stuff with this graph in the episode. You should just listen to it. But this was my favorite scene with this graph of clearance rates, where Madeline brings it to the sheriff, who's the guy who really should know all about it and is the one responsible for it, and she makes him answer for how low their clearance rates are.
This is our diagram.
Sheriff Sanner took the sheet of paper in his hands and stared at it.
So this is the percentages of the clearance rate. So highest in the 80s, 38% in 84, and then kind of 20s, 30s, and then as low in 2000 as 8%, and then 16% in 2014. These seem very low to me. Like, is this an acceptable clearance rate?
I don't think anything under 100% is. I want to clear everything that we get involved in.
Sure, but and you're not going to be able to clear 100%. So it's threshold of, you know, is there a bar that's, you know, every year, let's aim to clear 60%, or let's aim to
clear. Actually, the bar is we aim to clear them all.
So then why is there such a gap then between, like?
I don't know. I have no idea why there is. And again, I'm not satisfied unless it's 100%.
Madeline, since you're here, would you mind saying something if I asked you a question about this scene? Like, did this scene go the way you thought it would go? Like, when you brought that graph? And do you have a mic there that's on?
I do, yeah. I didn't know what to expect, I guess. I mean, I thought of different scenarios. Like, what if he knows the clearance rates? What if he doesn't? What if he, like, pulls out his... What if he has, like, dueling graphs, you know? What if he has his own and we're, like, matching them up? I was surprised by him saying, I want them... Just looking at these numbers and saying, well, I want him to be 100%. And just... The fact that he hadn't thought about this, like, he was looking at new information that was really, like, his own information from his own agency, was surprising to me.
And you guys do a lot with this graph. Like, by the time we get to the sheriff, you've already brought it to another expert who's kind of interpreted it, and before that, Will brought it to you, and you kind of respond to it also. Like, did you realize the graph would be so... When did you realize the graph would be so important to this episode? It's like a character in the story, almost.
Pretty early. So, I mean, we had Will, like, go off and not tell me what he was doing. Like, he would... And he would want to tell me. Like, I would see him... He'd be like, no, I'm not listening, I'm listening. Because I didn't want to know. And so when we were in a studio and he was telling me, I had him make a graph and then show it to me, and I didn't know what the numbers were. And then it worked because it was really clear. Like, I understood it right away. And then we're like, we're totally using this. We're like taking Will's. And we knew we had the audio from my discussion with Will. So I'm like, we need one graph for this thing. Because he had others. Like, the full audio, as like most data reporters would be more interested in, has like 30 graphs, you know, all kinds of stuff. But that was the one that to us was the most important, so we wanted to bring it all the way through to the end.
I love that you made him hide what he was working on. I wondered about that, because it sounds real, like you were actually responding in the moment to what he brings back to you. That's like, I aspire to use that technique someday. And Ike's going to just play one other excerpt from that episode. If you want to hold on to the mic in case people have another question, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I love this episode. I think you guys did a phenomenal job, and it's a great illustration of, like, you know, a master's level course on the tactics that we're talking about today. So after we meet this sheriff and you feel him fidgeting in his chair and not giving a very satisfying answer, Madeline goes, like, one level farther, and then another. Like, she keeps coming back to him. And I think that this is, like, a great moment where you're using, a graph to, like, just go for this guy's jugular. And he becomes the personification of this problem. And he's, like, his answers are, like, well, it involves a lot of luck, you know? And then he's like, well, he's talking about luck and wishes. And you're just like, oh, are you fucking kidding me? And you get like, boil. And at the boiling point of the listener, then you do this turn. And that's the next clip.
So this is what we've settled on in this country as the best way to handle solving major crimes. To leave it up to people like Sheriff John Sanner. Sheriffs who don't know their clearance rates, who have no clear plan about how to improve them, and who refuse to look back and see what they could have done differently. And Stearns County isn't the only place with a crime-solving problem. There are all kinds of places, all across the country, with Part 1 clearance rates in the single digits or not much higher. Farmington, New Mexico, your average clearance rate from 2005 to 2014 is 13%. East Chicago, Indiana, your clearance rate is 9%. Honolulu, your clearance rate is 6%. Assumption Parish, Louisiana, your clearance rate is 12%. King County, Washington, your clearance rate is 5%.
And then we just, like, see the devil in every town. And I thought that was really nicely done. I don't have a question. Does somebody have a question from Madeline? I just want to compliment.
Yeah, we have, like, 2 minutes left.
I asked Will to, like, come up with 15 towns, and then we just pick some. We wanted to have it geographically dispersed, and we didn't want it to have it be major cities that people might already know about. Like, we wanted to spread it out.
How much more time did it take for him to find out those clearance rates in all those places?
Oh, my gosh, I'd have to ask him. That, not as long, because he'd already done some work, but he did all the clearance rate thing in general took him 6 months.
Wow.
All of it, yeah. He did a ton of work.
There's one more question in the back.
Did you think that those similarly low numbers almost validated what you're finding in your local department in kind of showing that there might be reasons why it was difficult? How did you contextualize that?
Yeah, so they're not the only ones with a really low rate, but there were some, we talked earlier in the episode about how there are some places that solved, like, almost all their crimes, and that nobody knows why, like, there's this big difference between, like, some places solving almost all and other places solving almost none. And so our thinking was, you know, if people are thinking, well, I'm glad I don't live there, that we wanted to challenge that. So that's where we went in the end.
One last question.
So I just want to make a comment about that. The whole series, first of all, but was incredible. But what was so great about having that graph and that data was then Madeline just did the ballsiest thing I've heard in a really long time in her close to the series, which if you have not heard it, you have to listen to it. Because what these statistics do is they give you the power to make a statement. And a lot of times in journalism, we're afraid to say stuff because we want to make sure that we're not being impartial. But Madeline had the reporting, she had the statistics, she had the sheriff who could not respond to anything. So then she was able to say, this is what this tells us, which is basically, you know, it's not luck to solve these cases. You know, we have the ability to solve them, but we don't have the talent, or we have these bozos who aren't doing the work. And I just, you know, not to embarrass you, Madeline, but I just want to applaud you for that because, like, the lesson, you know, we're talking about ways to make data relevant. There's no better way to make data relevant than to come to a conclusion like that that you can land on and leave the listeners with. So congratulations.
Yeah, I can't think of a better place to end than that. So thanks, everybody, for coming.